For now, we turn to the Haggadah. And let's talk first about the Seder and where it came from. Okay. There is a lot of scholarly research and scholarly argument about when the Seder developed. There's no mention of a Seder in the Bible. And early mentions of the Seder don't have the full Seder that we have in front of us. The standard work on this, for those of you who are interested, was until very recently a book called The Origins of the Seder by Baruch Boxer, who was a scholar at the Jewish Theological Seminary, who unfortunately passed away very young. Some of you knew or heard of his father, Ben Zion Boxer, who was a very prominent American rabbi. But there's new research and new writing about it, but as with all new research and new writing, it's controversial. So I'm just going to tell you a few theories. I'm not going to try to arbitrate between them. But the idea behind the Seder in general, of course, and this everybody agrees with, is that it in some ways replicated the Passover sacrifice in the temple. And until the temple was destroyed, it's clear that the Passover celebration was quite different, because the central piece of it was to bring the Paschal Lamb to the temple and for the pilgrims to go up to the temple and offer the Paschal Lamb. And that was a huge event in the life of the people. Remember, there are three what are called regalim. We call them holidays or festivals, but regalim comes from the Hebrew word rega, which is leg. Three pilgrimage festivals: Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot. Okay, so that's when everybody would walk up to Jerusalem and they would sacrifice at the temple. The Paschal Lamb on your plate is a pale reminder of what that used to be. You can just imagine how powerful this idea was to actually take something that you had, to slaughter it, you know, to God at the time of the Passover sacrifice, to remember what God did for your ancestors in Egypt that allowed you to come to the land you lived in now. All right? And we'll come back to that in a minute. Late research of the past decade, as I mentioned last time, reinterprets the Seder as in part a reaction to the Christian interpretation of the Passover holiday. Because Passover, in the form of Easter, plays a very important role in Christianity too, and the central symbols of the Passover Seder have their place in Christianity as well. So the matzah is equivalent to?
The wafer.
The Paschal Lamb is equivalent to?
Jesus.
And the bitterness is the bitterness of Jesus' sacrifice and redemption. Okay, so the question in part is how much of the Seder, we have a lot, why don't you bring those in the back actually, thank you. We have Haggadahs here and anybody can just get, or on the table maybe. If you don't have a Haggadah, please take one and you're welcome to keep them. So the question in part is how much of this is an indigenous Jewish growth and how much of it is a reaction to Christian interpretation, because remember that Judaism and Christianity in some ways developed at the same time. And by that I mean Judaism as a rabbinic tradition, which is the Judaism we know, and Christianity were co-equal in time. The rabbis were writing the Talmud, the Mishnah and the Talmud at the same time that Christians were developing their interpretation of the Hebrew Bible as a precursor to the New Testament. So there's a lot of both interaction and also polemics, because after all, these were two antagonistic communities in the separation of Christianity from Judaism, and it left its footprints on history. No, Mishnah was begun before Christianity. The Mishnah was a reaction in part. Mishnahs already existed, and I don't want to get too much into the history of the Mishnah. Rabbis already had their own individual Mishnayot. The reason that the Mishnah was finally put in writing was the destruction of the temple and the loss of so many rabbis and teachers who could no longer transmit orally the teachings. Later, about 30.
Okay, 30, but the temple was destroyed at 70.
Right.
Was there a time between 30 and 70 where, how did we have all the symbolism of Jesus if he was still around? mean, how could it
have that's assuming that the Passover Seder was developed before the destruction of the temple. And what I'm saying is the Passover Seder is a reaction to the destruction of the temple. Right? Remember, all the things in the Seder are talking about this is how you remember it now because the temple no longer exists. So almost everybody agrees that the major development of the Seder is after the destruction. Before that, you had the sacrifice, you didn't need a Seder. And the development of the synagogue is largely also a reaction to the destruction of the temple. You don't have one place to go, now you have lots and lots of places to go. Okay, so that's in part some of the history of the Seder. Just two more things. To tie this into what we're going to study in 2 weeks, which of the patriarchs is the patriarch that is associated with Passover? Would you guess? It would make sense to say Isaac, right? But it actually is Abraham. Isaac is like the Passover sacrifice, but Abraham is the sacrificer. And in fact, Abraham is associated with Pesach, Isaac with Shavuot, and Jacob with Sukkot. So there's also this connection with Passover and the idea, of course, of the Akedah and the sacrifice of Isaac. And we'll talk about that more next time. But just to tie this to that, we should be aware of it. And it is, remember that what is most like Isaac in the Passover Seder and the sacrifice of Isaac is that God decreed the death of the firstborn, but the Jewish firstborn were saved, right? And that being saved, just as God decrees the death of Isaac, but Isaac is saved, and that salvation leads to redemption. Okay, let's start I don't think I'm gonna go through the entire Haggadah word by word, or even paragraph by paragraph. I do want to talk about a couple of opening things. For example, on page 8, this is how I'm going to start my sermon, actually, with this with these comments, and I did last night when we were talking about fundraising for the 4th and 5th floor. Let all who are hungry enter and eat. You see that? Yeah. All who are in need, come and celebrate the Passover. The very first paragraph. Kol dichvin yetevi yechul, kol ditrich yetevi yisach. Now, the question is, of course, why, and I say of course, despite the fact that before I read a commentary on it, I never thought of this question, why the repetition? Why, if you're hungry, come and eat, if you're needy, come and celebrate the Pesach? And the answer of the rabbis is, one is talking about a physical hunger, and the other is talking about a spiritual hunger. And for us, at our Sedarim, we're talking to spiritual hunger, because nobody will sit down at a Seder in our community and think, will I have enough food, right? Yes, exactly, quite the opposite. They'll think, how much will I overeat? Now I want to talk about the symbolism of it, and let's start with matzah. I want to read you a paragraph from Israel Yuval. He's the one who wrote this book, a very interesting book, but I won't recommend it to you only because it's a very scholarly book and you really have to work your way through it. It's not a breezy read. But Israel Yuval is an Israeli scholar, and he wrote first in Hebrew and then it was just translated to English, a book called Two Nations in Your Womb, quote from the Torah. And it's about Judaism and Christianity and their interaction throughout history, but especially focused on the Passover. But this is what he writes about matzah. In the ancient world, the rising and leavening of dough represented the power of civilization, human activity, interference in nature, while the matzah was the symbol of simplicity and primitivism, the bread of the unsettled nomad, the bread of affliction that lasts a long time. Now, there's lots of symbolism in that, and in fact, in matzah, there's lots of different kinds of symbolism. Remember, matzah starts out the Seder as the symbol of slavery, but at the end, with the afikomen, it's the symbol of redemption. In fact, the afikomen is, and I'll talk about this in a little while, by some rabbis taken as a symbol of the Mashiach, and I'll talk about why. But, so is matzah a good thing or a bad thing? You know, on the one hand, it's the last taste you're supposed to have in your mouth when you finish the Seder. Lo maftirim machara pesach afikomen. You don't have anything after the afikomen, and I'll also tell you what afikomen really means, because it doesn't really mean matzah. But clearly it's supposed to be a bread of affliction, right? Halachma anya. And anya, like aniyut in the modern Hebrew, means poverty or affliction or all those bad things. So a couple of interpretations about matzah. those of you who get Off the Pulpit, which is the weekly email that I send out, I think either this, maybe it's this coming week. I think it's this coming week. You will read the following. My like revelation of what matzah was all about came from Mary Moody Emerson. Mary Moody Emerson was Ralph Waldo Emerson, the great American philosopher and writer. He was his aunt, and he found her a tremendous inspiration. She was clearly an unusual and brilliant woman, and one of those women who would have been very famous had she been born, you know, before she was born in the 1700s, had she not been born in the 1700s. Instead, we only know her through the influence that she had on Ralph Waldo Emerson. And someone in his presence once said to her, "Mary, hurry up." And she said, "Hurry is for slaves." And when I read that, I thought, matzah. The whole point of it is that because they couldn't control their own time, they had to bake matzah. And not being able to control your own time, I mean, within reason, none of us controls our own time, right? I mean, when I said hurry is for slaves, you probably thought of your kids, right? They're slaves, we're slaves, you know, we're all slaves. Hurry up for school. But the constant, the never, I mean, to be a slave is to never, ever, ever control your time, ever. And matzah is an indication of that. And the reason that it's important to realize it is the Jews didn't only bake matzah when they left Egypt. They were already eating matzah before, and they even assumed that what Abraham served to the angels, unleavened cakes of bread, it says, could be matzah. So it's not, and as you see from Yuval's quote, nomads eat matzah. That's what they eat. So it's a very, I actually read a long essay by a guy who talked about the fact that if you don't have matzah in the ancient world, what you have is sourdough bread. And sourdough bread has to rise either in the day or in the night, but it has to rise for whatever, 12 hours or something like that. And that's the history behind matzah, is the sourdough, and what's left over, you have to take some of it out. And it was a long analysis of anybody's interest. If anybody bakes bread, you might find it interesting. But that idea that matzah represents your inability to control your time, to me, makes a lot of sense, especially because, remember, one of the things that we don't do so much in Seders anymore, but that the Seders you used to do in the Seder was recline, right? That's one of the questions. Why do we recline? And reclining is, you know, I'm hanging out here. I don't have to rush. I don't have to get up. I don't have to hurry. Okay, so you have three matzahs. The three matzahs, again, by the way, some people celebrate with two matzahs. Traditionally, there are those who use two matzahs. Most use three. There are lots of interpretations of what the three matzahs are. Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, three different kinds of Jews. And Levi gets to be the Afikomen because the Leviim were the one tribe that never worshipped the golden calf, right? Or they could be the three seahs of flour that Abraham has in chapter 18, mixes in order to bring the angels these cakes. Anyway, whatever the idea is, but let's talk for a minute about the Afikomen. Afikomen, which was the subject of a lot of research, because you can hear, if you have at all an ear for Hebrew, you can hear Afikomen is not a Hebrew word, right? It's Greek. And the second strain, I meant to mention this before, the second strain of research into the Seder is the parallels between a Greek meal, a Greek celebratory meal, and the Seder, and there are lots and lots and lots of them. Clearly, some of the Seder was taken from surrounding Hellenistic and Greek sources, and the Afikomen is one of them. I didn't bring, David Galinkin wrote an article where he enumerates all the parallels between the Greek meal and the Afikomen. And again, if anybody is interested, I'd be happy to make it available to you. The Afikomen was a practice of going from house to house and eating more when you were done with your own feast among the Greeks. That's what it means. It means to leave afterwards and to eat more. The rabbis wanted the Pesach Seder to be in every house. Every house should be open. You shouldn't need to go to another house. So there's no Afikomen in this. It in time came to mean dessert, because the end of the meal, right? It's funny, it sort of got reversed. Instead of saying no Afikomen, there is an Afikomen, right? But you can tell the origin by saying after the meal, Eim aftirin achara pesach afikomen. After the meal, right, there's no afikomen. That means there's no going to someone else's house. However, the breaking of it and the giving it out is very old, right? This is a pretty old custom, goes back to medieval times, as a lot of the Seder does. And it became associated with the Messiah. Can anyone guess why? Why would the Afikomen be associated with the Messiah?
Simple, unassuming.
Simple, unassuming is good. What else? It's the last thing, and redemption is at the end, and there's one more thing. The most obvious thing about the Afikomen. What do you do with the Afikomen? Yeah. You hide it, and then, right, it's part of a broken off whole that gets, I mean, that gets reunited. You don't actually reunite it, but you eat it at the end. So both those things, that's what happens with the Messiah. The Messiah is hidden and will restore the brokenness of the world. So you can see why symbolically the Afikomen has that meaning. It's a very nice symbol. And lastly, by the way, which is also true, who finds the Afikomen? Children. And there's a lot of child symbolism in the Messianic age too. In fact, remember what we read in the Haftarah on this Shabbat is Malachi's beautiful messianic prediction, Veheshiv levavot al banim velev banim al avotam, that the hearts of parents will be turned to children and children turned to parents. That's what will happen in the messianic age. So, for all those reasons, that's the symbol of matzah. Now let me say a couple words about karpas, about the symbol of the greens, which represents spring, first of all, obviously, because Passover is a spring holiday. And the reason that you know that Passover, that these holidays have a lot to do with the harvest, is Passover is liberation, and Sukkot is about what? Dwelling in the, well, yes, but the hope, but also dwelling in the wilderness, which means that it should come right after Passover, shouldn't it? I mean, if you think about it, they were liberated to the desert. They had to live in something. So if it was really only about the history, you'd have Passover, and next week you'd have Sukkot, and then in 3 weeks you'd have Shavuot, and you'd be done. But it's but history and the cycle of the world, that is the linear cycle, history which moves this way, and the cycle of the crops which move that way, got combined. So you get the harvest festival at the, and in fact, as we'll talk about in a minute, the passage that stands at the heart of the Haggadah, my father was a wandering Aramean, right? Arami Oved Avi. That passage is actually from Shavuot. It's the passage where you bring the first fruits, which you do on Shavuot. But it's at the heart of the Haggadah, which we'll come to. So for those of, by the way, those of you who did bring a chumash, who brought a Bible, it's in Deuteronomy chapter 26. That's the passage that the rabbis choose to put in the middle of the Haggadah. So, all right. So karpas, first of all, is spring. The salt water are tears. And also you dip twice to stimulate the curiosity of children, because you usually dip once, but if you dip twice, they're going to be curious. And lastly, what place, here's a little biblical quiz, in the Torah, actually in the book of Genesis, I'll narrow it down, does dipping play a very important part in the story of Egypt? Yes?
Dipping Joseph's coat.
Excellent. Give that man an A. That's good. When they dip Joseph's coat in blood, remember, and they bring it to the father and they say, he died. He was killed. And that, of course, that whole thing starts a chain of events leading Joseph to Egypt and eventually leading the family to Egypt, which ends up in redemption. So when you're in a closed circle, everything reminds you of everything else. You know, if you live in the world of the Bible and you see dipping, well, you know, it automatically moves you to previous examples of dipping, because remember that the rabbis lived in this book, right? In a way that we don't live in anything, because there's just too much around us. You know, we don't read only one text and live in one world where we talk about these stories all the time, so they're constantly on the tips of our tongues. Also, by the way, something that I learned from one of the Haggadot that I never heard or learned before, which is worth mentioning, and I hope I'll remember it next Purim to say it, is that if you do the calculations in the Megillah, Haman is hung on Pesach, which is fascinating. And the guy does all the calculations and shows that it's clearly deliberate, but I've read commentaries on the Megillah and don't ever remember seeing that before. But he's not hung on Purim, he's hung on Pesach. Because he's hung, and remember, then there are a series of events before Purim happens. Anyway, I'm trying to remember which Haggadah I saw that in. It wasn't Boxers. I have it somewhere. Anyway, for those of you who are interested, it's kind of a fascinating thing. Okay. I know. It was in... Right. I'll check it. If you're interested, I'll be happy to find it and show it to you. Because I have the page number here, and I don't have which Haggadah it was in, which is not helpful. So what I have to do is look through all the Haggadot. I look through and find page. It's on page 230, by the way, if anybody's interested. It just doesn't say which book, right? Great note-taking. You wonder how historians get in trouble. That's what they do. They take notes over years, and then because they took it 4 years ago, they think this was their own observation. They forgot that it was from... So I usually, I try to remember, but... all right. So matzah and bitter herbs, the korech, is the good and evil inclination together. Now here's another meaning of matzah, right? What else does matzah mean? Matzah means humility. We talked about that, I think, last time. Bread is puffed up. Right? Bread is not what it appears to be. If you look at a loaf of bread, looking at a loaf of bread is like looking at a box of cereal. You know, when they say sold by weight, not by volume, and so you open it up and it's half full, and there's a big box of cereal, and there's almost not, that's what bread is, right? Bread is full of air, it's puffed up. So bread represents arrogance in Jewish tradition, and matzah represents humility, because matzah, what you see is what you get. There's nothing extra in matzah. So when you eat matzah and bitter herbs together, you get the good and the bitter. And also, even it's a kind of a strange irony that even though this is a holiday where women work very hard, and you know there are all sorts of Jewish jokes about that. The most famous being, well, not the most famous, but about the Jew who comes home and he tells his wife, "Look, we can't make it as Jews. We have to convert. I'm sorry, I don't want to, but you know, it's so hard out there. We've got to convert." So she agrees. They convert to Christianity, and he comes home a month later from work and he says, "You know what? There's been a change of regime. The new king likes the Jews. Let's convert back." She said, "Wait till after Pesach." There is this idea, obviously, right? Women are enslaved on Pesach, but it's strangely the one holiday. It's the most equal holiday in a way, because women are obligated for all the mitzvot that men are obligated for on Pesach, like the four cups of wine and the telling of the story and all of that. The one mitzvah traditionally that women weren't obligated for is, and this will be, you either think of this as just a legal nicety or very characteristic. They don't have to recline. Now that may either be because they didn't have time to recline, or I want you to know the explanation in the how this was from one of the traditional Haggadot was it was not a practice of women to recline in ancient times. That's all I can. I should say the fact that you're not obligated to recline doesn't mean you're not allowed to recline. It just means you don't have to, right? okay. Not only were women at the table with the men, they ate together, but as I mentioned before, if you read, Lee Levine wrote a very big book called Ancient Synagogues. It's a big, beautiful, but, you know, scholarly work about the excavations of ancient synagogues. And in one of them, they excavated a synagogue where in the front row, there's the name of a woman etched into the seat, which means, A, that she gave the money for it, because name plaques are as old as humanity, apparently, right? In the cave paintings, it probably said, you know, donated by Og. But but also that there was no mechitza in ancient times, that men and women sat together in ancient synagogues, and the mechitza was a development maybe during Roman times. But that's a, okay, another story. So I wanted to, one of the, and then now we're going to come in a second to the story, but the central part of this obviously is the Magid, is the telling of the story. And here, and then I'll take the comment, David Hartman, in A Different Night, which is a really nice Haggadah and has lots and lots and lots of interesting stuff, he says, the Seder turns parents into storytellers, which is a lovely observation, and that really is what you're supposed to be to your children on the night of the Seder, is a storyteller. Yeah, Dave?
Yeah, it occurred to me, if matzah is supposed to be about humility, now they have everything matzah. They're basically
right.
Accessorizing matzahs and showing
them. Yes.
Would
right.
that be something that would, you know, symbolically not be considered?
Yep. Actually, you're not. There is stuff called matzah ashira, enriched matzah, with eggs, with other things, that still doesn't rise, but you're not allowed to use at the Seder, according to most authorities, and some people say you shouldn't use it all of Passover. For exactly that reason, is it's not like real matzah. So I remember, I just told this story the other day. Arthur Hertzberg, of blessed memory, who just passed away a little while ago, was a very famous American rabbi and a very learned one. And I was once with him in New Jersey, and I mentioned that I had just seen kosher crab. They were making crab out of pollock.
Oh, yes.
Pollock, you know, I mean, it was not crab, obviously. And he said that he objected to all those sorts of things because kashrut wasn't only about, you know, evading the letter of the law, it was about being conscious of what you're eating and making a commitment to eat a certain way. And the idea that you eat kosher, but in fact you can eat everything that you can eat when you're not kosher, was to him against the spirit of kashrut. Yeah.
I was just going to say about the puffed upness, and what about the Shabbat having challah, which is clearly puffed up?
It's only, you only hear this matzah challah thing on Pesach. Right, the rest of the year, you know, bread is considered a wonderful thing. So, that's what she was saying on Shabbat. All symbols are to be taken with a grain of salt. You know, none of them are. Look at matzah. Matzah is sometimes a symbol for good things, sometimes a symbol for bad things. So, what can I tell you? But you're right. Okay. So, on the passage that is at the heart of the Haggadah is this passage of "My father was a wandering Aramean," and here you find it. Where is it? There's Vayered Mitzrayma. Okay, so page 15, at the very bottom, the last sentence, as it says. See the third line up from the bottom, "An Aramean sought to destroy my father." The printing in this is not, yeah, it's tiny and it's light. A great combination. So, right, exactly. Arami oved avi. Here they translate it as "An Aramean sought to destroy my father." Elsewhere it's translated differently. "A wandering Aramean was my father." But this is what you say when you bring your first fruits to the temple. You say, "An Aramean sought to destroy my father, and he went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there he became a great nation, mighty and numerous." Right? And then it breaks it up to tell the rest of the story. But that passage, which is in Deuteronomy 26, is one paragraph that tells in capsule form the history of the Jewish people. And when you bring your first fruits to the temple, you recite that passage. Now, the first fruits are a tax, basically, just as sacrifices are, right? The priests end up eating the sacrifices and the first fruits. It would be as if when you came to pay your taxes on April 15th, you said, you know, "And the Mayflower came to the shores, and they established colonies here, and we fought a war with the British," and so on and so forth. "And so today I'm paying my taxes." which is a way of establishing this historical continuity between what happened in Jewish history and what you're doing today. And the Haggadah, which people don't always realize is that one story taken and broken up into lots and lots and lots of little bits, and in between each little bit of that story from the Bible is lots of rabbinic commentary. Okay? That's the heart of the Haggadah, is a commentary on that one paragraph. But that one paragraph, because it tells the story of the Jewish people, especially of the Exodus, in a shortened form, that one paragraph becomes very rich for the story of the plagues and the story of crossing the sea and so on, with the absence of one important character who's not discussed at all in the Haggadah. Moses, right, is not in the Haggadah. And I read in Baruch Boxer's book the best explanation, and I'll have to mention it. Sid Burke asked me the other day, why isn't Moses mentioned? And I gave all the traditional answers, but I hadn't read this one yet, which seems to me the best one of all. The traditional answer that people give is so that you should know that God, not Moses, delivered the Jewish people, so that people shouldn't worship Moses, that kind of thing. But Boxer's answer seems to me to make more sense. He said the Passover Seder was read in communities where people were desperate for redemption. And if you make redemption contingent on Moses, they'll despair because Moses is gone and gone forever. But God isn't. And if you emphasize that it was God, it doesn't matter if there's a Moses or there isn't a Moses. God can do this, then people still have hope, which I thought was a beautiful answer and actually made a lot of sense. So even though Moses clearly in the Torah is the most prominent character, when it comes to please bring us redemption now, opening the door, hoping Eliyahu comes in to announce the Messiah, you want to make sure that people don't think that they need Moses in order to accomplish that, because they don't. Okay? All right. Yeah?
On the other hand.
You do need Moses. So funny you should ask that. No, it wasn't. It actually wasn't a setup. I did not know that she was going to say that, but, oh, did I not write it down? Oh, that's such a shame. One second. I'll repeat the comment and... Oh, I did. Good. The comment was, on the other hand, you do need a Moses, because every time the Jews have been delivered or saved, there's been someone who takes Moses' place. That's true, but you don't need Moses. You need a Moses. And so let me read you a little passage that I wrote down from Herzl's journal. Herzl being the modern Moses in this sense. This is what he wrote in his journal. I recall receiving a thrashing. A thrashing is a beating, okay? Because I did not remember the details of the exodus of the Jews from Egypt. Nowadays, many schoolmasters would like to thrash me because I remember the exodus only too well. So yes, you do need a Moses, but it can be a Moses. I mean, Herzl here is a completely irreligious Jew, knew nothing about Judaism, nothing. Never went to synagogue, but became Moses. So part of the reason why it's dangerous to put Moses in there is if you have a human model, it creates expectations about what the next model has to be like. And sometimes the next model is nothing like the Moses you expect. I mean, Herzl was a dilettante and a playwright and a man about town. Nobody would have picked him for the next Moses before he became the next Moses. So, yeah.
Would anyone have picked Moses to be the next Moses?
No. You wouldn't have, actually. In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. It's an interesting question. But I'm gonna leave that aside. Although, as long as we're on Moses, let me just say a couple more words about Moses, because I don't actually have to give you all my notes. One of the interesting questions that I got was why did Moses's mother put him by the river? Because after all, you got to figure Jews weren't going by the river looking for babies, since all their kids were being killed, and any Egyptian that would find him by the river was likely to kill him. Who thought that an Egyptian would find him and save him? So the answer that the rabbi gave, and I have his name, who asked the question, was she was hoping for a miracle. And I thought, that's a reasonable answer, but if you're hoping for a miracle, so you hope for a miracle at home. What does she have to bring him to the river for? To which my answer was that you have to do some work. Miracles don't come of themselves. They also require effort. We were discussing this at home, and Ellie said also any woman who's ever given birth knows that water is the source of life, and that if you want to save a life, to go to a river, to go to a source, to go to a spring, to go to water is a sort of natural, and in fact, Moshe means drawn from the water. That's what we're told in the Bible that the name means. So there is this very nice redemptive part of Moses' living that isn't mentioned in the Haggadah itself, but is part of the Passover story. All right, let me just get through a few more. The four questions, since everybody does the four questions, the first two, which are about matzah and maror, are about bondage. The last two, which are about karpas, about greens, and about reclining, move to freedom, right? So even in the structure of the four questions, there's something of the structure of the whole Haggadah, and the whole Haggadah is matchil begenut umisayim b'shevach, which means you begin in shame, genut is shame, and you end in praise. So the question is, what's the shame with which you begin? And here there's a very famous debate in the Talmud. Shmuel says the shame is slavery, but Rav says the shame is idolatry, because the Jews began as idol worshippers. Remember the story of Abraham's father, right? That he's an idol worshipper. So if you begin at the beginning of Jewish history, we all started out as idol worshippers, but we end with the liberation and belief in one God. So the passage that we chose for the Haggadah, the Jewish people, chose for the Haggadah is according to Shmuel, right? It begins in slavery. It doesn't begin in idolatry. But it's interesting that both of those, four cups. Cups are mentioned four times, which I did not know until this year, in Pharaoh's recitation of his dream and Joseph's interpretation. So again, there's a tie back to the Joseph story, just like the dipping in blood, because remember, the Joseph story is how we got down to Egypt in the first place. And also, let's move to the four sons, because I have a great one on the four sons. I like this one a lot. Those of you who are psychologically minded, get ready for a really good observation from the Netziv, Reb Chaim of Volozhin, who was a famous Torah scholar, on the four sons. Now all we have to do is find the four sons. Thank you. Page 12. So look at this. First of all, there's always a debate about why the wicked son phrasing is wicked. There are a lot of theories. None of them are great. But I'm actually less interested in that than... Okay. All right. This is what it says. Okay. What do you do with the wise son? Right? You say to him, these are the laws, these are the customs, these are the traditions, right? That's what you do. Look at the first paragraph. Now, what do you say to the simple son? It says, you say to him, with a mighty hand, God brought us forth, right? What do you say to the simple son? You introduce the subject to him, this is done, right? You tell your son on that day. All of the responses are directed to the child. When you go to the wicked son, what do? You set your teeth on edge by saying, therefore you answer, and you say, it's because of what God did for me. Reb Chaim of Volozhin says, when someone challenges you, it's always a mistake to respond to them in terms of them. What you do is you affirm your own position. When the wicked son says, what is it to you? You don't say, how dare you ask that sort of question. Instead, you say, this is what God did for me. This is where I stand. That's how you draw someone. And the reason I think it's so brilliant is, I mentioned this the other day in a class, I read a book, which I really should reread, called Generation to Generation. It was written by a rabbi who's also a family systems therapist. And he said, in a congregation, I remember a few things from the book. One of the things I remember vividly, he said, in any congregation, if you want to know which people are self-differentiated, that is, which people really are themselves, as opposed to people who are always defining themselves in terms of everyone else, okay? You understand what I'm talking about to start off with? In other words, if I'm always thinking who I am because of who you are, I'm not self-differentiated. He said, if you want to know which people are self-differentiated, this is what you do. You give a controversial sermon. Okay? He said, and then you will get two different kinds of reactions. The reactions of people who are not self-differentiated will be, Rabbi, how could you say that? The reactions of people who are self-differentiated will be, I'll tell you why I believe differently. And when I read the comment of the Netziv, that's exactly what he's saying. He's saying, don't say to him, you shouldn't believe that. Say to him, this is what I believe, right? Had you been there, you would not have been part of my group, because this is what my group believes. And that's exactly what you say to him. And I thought it may not be easy to explain it as Seder, but it's a brilliant insight into the response to the wicked child. And also, it's a good thing just to keep in mind that instead of trying to change what someone else believes, You just affirm to them what you believe, and you discover often that it lingers. It lingers much better. You don't make them immediately defensive, but they know who you are, and maybe that will seep in over time. Okay, let me just mention a couple of other things. Oh, this is a good one. Yes. Yes, it's called by Edwin Friedman, Friedman, and it is a really fascinating book. And I really should reread it, because I remember, I mean, it was 10 years ago when I first came here that I read it, and I remember thinking how many valuable comments there were. I'll tell you one other thing. This is also useful, especially with kids, that he says that is a commonplace, but it's amazing how often it happens in congregations. He says that it is the job of somebody who is in any kind of position of authority to step out of the triangle that people will put you in. When they come to and say, you know, I have a fight with this person, I want you to go to them and solve it. And because you know, as a parent between two kids, that you actually can't ever really solve the fight, you have to return them to the interaction between the two of them, that's your function as a mediator is, in fact, to make yourself dispensable, to eventually return the parties to each other, because you actually can't fix what's going on between two other people, even though you always assume you can. Right? It's a good book. From Generation to Generation by Edwin Friedman.
The spelling of his name?
Friedman. okay. Comment is that you know, God works all these plagues on the Egyptians and then promises in chapter 15 of the Exodus, I will never do to you, right? The afflictions that I brought on Egypt, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought on in Egypt. And of course, that's not literally true. So the rabbis say what God means by that is when it says, I won't bring on you the afflictions that I brought on Egypt, when I brought them on Egypt, they truly became afflictions because nobody changed. It's not an affliction if it causes you to change. It's only an affliction if it leaves you where you are. And all through the plagues in Egypt, they obviously didn't change, because at the end, they still wouldn't let the Israelites go, right? Even after the death of the firstborn. And remember, those of you who are firstborn, Monday morning, you're supposed to fast on Monday unless you have a siyum. So Monday morning, you can come, and 7:30, we have a service, and then I'll do some study with you. And then we'll have a bagel and coffee and orange juice.
Do you have elves that will come to your house and fix the rest of the
seder? What's that?
Do you have elves that will come to your house and fix the rest of the seder?
Sure, absolutely. We have an elf service that will, yes. It doesn't apply to women. I mean, women are welcome to come to the service, and many do. It's not necessary legally, because it was only the firstborn sons who were passed over in Egypt. Yes. In fact, if you... Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. Go ahead.
I had a question about the four sons.
Yes.
With the wise son and the wicked son.
It seems the same question.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's what I said before. There's a lot of interpretations about why the wicked son is wicked, because it seems the same question. Most of it fixes on lachem instead of etchem. Etchem seems inclusive in the Hebrew, and lachem is just to you. So most interpretations are that he's excluding himself, but there's more. Yeah, that's the idea, right? But it's tricky. It's not so clear. Yeah. Go ahead.
To this one, which is there a lot of times when there's this message of freedom given, there's some kind of an uprising, you know, there's rebellion or keeping yourself. Was there a political content to the Seder at the point that this?
Oh. I'm actually glad that you said, well, yeah, let me say two things about that. First, the first question was, what's the significance of the number four? It recurs a lot. There are four letters in God's name, Yud Heh Vav Heh. I mean, so I think that I don't know ultimately what the cosmic significance is, but like the number 13, like the number 40, like the number 7, it has very recurrent patterns in Jewish tradition as well as in other traditions. Was there a political context to the formation of the Seder? You know, there's a passage in the Seder where it talks about how Rabbi Akiva and others talked about the Seder until the morning broke, and then they said it's time for the Shema. The interpretation of Louis Finkelstein, among others, is that they were planning the Bar Kokhba rebellion at that time. Some scholars don't think so, some do, but it's probably true that the Seder was a place where political freedom was talked about historically, and in fact there is a book by Michael Walzer called Exodus and Revolution, where he talks about how the Exodus served as a paradigm for revolutionary movements throughout history, including in the Civil War. If you look through the literature of the Civil War, there's very little quotation of the New Testament, but there's a great deal of quotation of the Hebrew Bible, and that makes sense, because in the New Testament there's no political liberation. So all the spiritualist hymns, you know, they all make reference to crossing the Jordan, the Promised Land, all of that, because that's political liberation. Liberation theology in Latin America is very Hebrew Bible based. The Puritans, when they came to America, you know, spoke Hebrew and quoted the Hebrew Bible a lot. It's why the motto of Yale University, go figure, is in Hebrew. So all those kinds of things are a political. All right. I want to be sure to mention one more thing, and then I'll tell you why I want to mention it. And that's about Chag Gadyah. Here's why I want to mention it. It's because of who taught it to me. There's a great Chag Gadyah, by the way, is on page 60. First, I'll tell you who taught it to me, and then I'll tell you what the teaching is. The Kotzker Rebbe said when he went back to his town, the first person that he went to visit was the schoolmaster who taught him the alphabet. And when they asked him why, he said, because it's the person who taught me the one thing that I've never doubted, and that's the basis for everything else I know. Which is, you know, I mean, you can always count on the Kotzker Rebbe for an unusual comment, but there is something about your earliest teachers that has a special resonance. And for years, when I lived in Harrisburg till I was 10, and everybody, all the kids went to junior congregation, right? It was a very different world. The parents went to the synagogue and the kids all went to junior congregation. There was he was a survivor, his name was Mr. Weiss, and he led junior congregation. And I remember two things about Mr. Weiss. One was that if you did anything in junior congregation, he would give you surreptitiously, you weren't supposed to see it, he would sort of slip it to you, even though everybody knew it and everybody got one, a Luden's cough drop. A cherry cough drop. The cherry cough drop, and if you got a cherry cough drop, that was your reward for having done whatever it was, opening the ark. And I remember one thing, my brother and I have talked about this, the only thing I remember that he taught us from those years was one thing that he taught us about Chag Gadyah, and it has the flavor of something that he must have learned when he was a kid, because it's clearly a lesson for a kid. Look at Chag Gadyah. This is what he said. He says, one kid that my father bought me for 2 zuzim, right? So the kid is good. Then along comes a cat and eats the kid, so the cat is bad. Then along comes a dog and eats the cat, so the dog is good. Then comes a stick, the stick is bad, and I'll just go bad and good. The fire is good, the water is bad, the ox is good, the slaughter is bad, the angel of death is good, and the Holy One is bad. Now, how can that be? Right? And that was the question he posed to us, and this is the answer that he gave. He said, when the cat came and ate the kid, the angel of death was already there. Otherwise, the kid wouldn't have died. So he says, you see, the cat was really good because the cat didn't do it. The angel of death did it, and the dog is bad, and you recalibrate all of it, and it turns out that the angel of death is bad and the Holy One is good. Now, you can hear that this is obviously a teaching for little kids, but I remember it, and so I want to, in Mr. Weiss's memory, wherever he may be, I want to perpetuate that teaching. And then just to close, I want to read you two quick paragraphs that I brought with me both to read. One is, this is just a great story from the Talmud, and then I want to close with a quote from Viktor Frankl. This actually occurs in the Talmud. The point of the four questions is to get questions done. They've become routinized, but the idea is you've got to stimulate questions. And we know this in part from the following story. Abaye and Rava are two very famous rabbis in the Talmud, two of the most famous. So once when Abaye was a young pupil, when he was still a student, before he'd become a famous rabbi, he was invited to the Seder of his teacher, Rabbah. When he was at the beginning of the Seder, Rabbah ordered the servants to clear the dishes from the table, right, before they had even been served. Amazed, Abaye said, "Why are you removing the Seder plate before we've even eaten?" Rabbah said, "Your question has served the same functions as the usual four questions of the Manish Tana. Now that a question has been asked, let's dispense with those and go right to the telling of the story." The whole idea is just you got to get someone to ask a question and then you can tell the story. And finally, from Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. The Hebrew word for Egypt, Mitzrayim, means tight spot or narrow strait where we feel boxed in. One day, a few days after liberation from the concentration camp, I walked through the country past flowering meadows for miles and miles toward the market town near the camp. Larks rose in the sky and I could hear their joyous song. There was no one to be seen for miles around. There was nothing but the wide earth and sky and the birds' jubilation and the freedom of space. I stopped, looked around, up to the sky, and then I went down on my knees. At that moment, there was very little I knew of myself or of the world. I had but one sentence in my mind and always the same. I called to the Lord from my narrow prison. God answered me in the freedom of space. That's Psalm 118. Min hametzar karati ya anani b'merchav ya. It's in the Hallel and it's in the Haggadah. How long I knelt there and repeated this sentence, memory can no longer recall. But I know on that day, in that hour, my new life started. Step for step, I progressed until I again became a human being. Chag Sameach. Have a wonderful and kosher Pesach.